Last time we were talking about remote procedure calls. So we mentioned we had this idea that we'd write these. That we write our normal functions in our server. And that we'd have our RPC library, which would generate a server stub that would stand in for the caller on the remote machine. And we'd have our client program would call a client stub. And in between, we'd have this library that implemented these remote procedure calls, which would turn it into network operations using the socket abstraction we talked about. And we started looking at like what the syntax for this might look like. And one thing we mentioned was that we'd have something a little different than a normal function call because there's some extra information we need. We need to somehow get across the info about, well, we at least need to name the server we're talking to. And we could imagine doing that by having sort of an extra, what's often called a context argument, or a common modern approach is we'd have an object-oriented interface, and you'd get an object that corresponds to a particular server which has these procedure calls, and they become method calls on both ends. So one thing that we see in this picture that we mentioned has to happen is that we have arguments to the function being reconverted into bytes. So this process is known as marshalling. And you might say, OK, well, let's just like copy the bytes that were passed into the arguments. But we can't quite do that. So one big problem is if we think of like a natural C function, we have things like pointers. If we have a char star, what are we supposed to do for that? Are we supposed to assume it's a string and copy that over? Is it the case that the function on the server is going to modify this and we expect to see the changes? We need more information. And we also have an issue of different types of machines. So if I'm calling a remote procedure call from a client, which is my phone, and it's implemented on a big beefy server, those might run different computing architectures where if we have like a long, maybe that has a different size on the two machines. And we need to somehow deal with that. We also have endianness that we need to worry about. Because unlike a local procedure call where, well, of course it's throwing the same ISA, this is not always going to be true. So because we need this extra information about what the arguments actually are, we're going to have our procedure calls specified using what's known as an interface description language. So we won't just have normal prototypes. We're going to have a list in a special language which tells what are the remote procedures we want to have and what types do they take. And the author of the RPC server is going to write these down. And this is what it's going to be compiled into our stubs with all our code for converting things to bytes and so on. You might say, well, couldn't we just use a header file? And this is a real option. But using an IDL allows the RPC auth library to get all this extra information that is hard to get otherwise. Like if we have a character array as an argument, like, how is that supposed to be represented? Is it variable length, null terminated, and so on? This is really handy to know if you're sending something over the network. And, you know, and really important to know if you're taking a call and you just get a character array with no length, how do you know what that is? So you need extra information. If we have, like, array arguments with sizes, what are the sizes? If we have a pointer argument, is this something we expect to modify or just keep the same? Who's supposed to allocate memory? So like if it returns an array, is it the expectation that that's allocated with malloc or what? So we have all these sort of decisions that wouldn't be just inherent from a header file. And there's also some goals about, I mentioned, what if it's a different architecture? Often, RPC systems have a loftier goal of being language neutral. Because the idea is you write your RPC server in, you know, whatever language you want, and you'll have lots of people using your library from not just, you know, whatever language you wrote it in. So if I write a RPC server in C++, a goal of RPC libraries often is that someone using my RPC server can use it from C++ and Python and Java, and I don't have to change anything. But to make this happen, we need to define kind of a different system of types and how arguments are passed that's sufficiently generic that we can map it to something in all those languages that just makes sense. And there's another issue of that we'll get to a little later, which is about versioning. So with a normal library, when you upgrade the library, well, you're going to upgrade your code that links to the library along with it. With an RPC server, that story doesn't work so well. Because if I upgrade my library, then it's an RPC server. Now everything that was contacting the RPC server needs to deal with the upgraded version. So we want to do something a little smarter about what if someone's still using the same server and I want to add new features. How do I make sure that doesn't break anything? So I'll give a pseudocode example of how this interface description language and marshalling might work, and then we'll do a real example using the RPC system we'll use in the assignment, which is a little more complicated because it's real. So in this example, I need to define, well, my server implements something. So I'm going to have a container for that. In this case, I call this a protocol and this pseudo IDL. And I say, these are my set of remote procedure calls that my server is going to implement. And I give it a argument type and a return type. And I've happened to number these. And the reason I number them is to give the RPC library a convenient way of sending them in sockets without writing out the name. It also lets me change the name. Like if I decide, wait, make dir is a really bad name, I should write make directory. I can do that without changing what's sent over the network. And based on this, the RPC library gets to choose some way of writing out this data that just has to be turn it into bytes. So for example, it might make the choice that this string type turns into a bunch of characters and a null terminator. And this int32 type we just send as a little endian 32-bit integer. That might be the choice we make. So in that case, our client stub would generate the number of the method to say this is a make dir, not an rm dir, and then write to the socket the name and a null terminator, and the server would send back the return value as 4 bytes. So questions on I've gone through here, and are just our general motivation for using an interface description language. Okay, so I'm going to show some examples of gRPC. So this is what we'll use for an upcoming assignment. And it's a little more complicated because it's a real system. It also does some things which you might say make it even more apparent that it's not really a local procedure call. Like we've been kind of drifting further and further away from that original goal, and it looks just like a local function call to a normal local function. And you'll be sad to see that these real industrial systems have gone maybe a little further than you might expect is necessary. So first, we need an IDL. So here's our interface description language, and here's how it works for gRPC. We have messages, and these messages, I guess, turn into C++ classes, and I should mention, because our assignment is in Python, plus Python classes, with accessors and marshalling to marshalling functions. And this is actually a library that gRPC was built on top of just for marshaling and unmarshaling, that's converting to bytes and back away from bytes. And you might say, okay, so we have a string path equals one, and so on. Oh, and I guess it occurs to me that I gave an example with a version which didn't have the required keywords, which I that in the assignment. So those are not, there's a, in the future version of this, they don't appear. So we have string path and equals one, string name equals two. So we have these fields which are numbered. And you might say, why are they numbered? This is part of how the messages are sent over the network. So when we send this makedir args messages, the way it's going to be sent is key one, value, and that string. And the idea of doing this is going to be about allowing you to change the name of the field if you decide path isn't the right name, and allowing you to add new fields without breaking prior systems. Because they can just say, oh, field two, I don't know what that is. That's OK. I just know that it's something else that I probably don't care about. We also have this service here. And this is what represents our remote server and the functions it implements. And we see how these names, and they'll become methods of a Python class or assignment. And they have an argument and a return value. You might say, well, you only have one argument here. That's probably like just because you only need one argument. It's actually the rule in this gRPC. They decided to keep things simpler. The arguments to an RPC method are always going to be a single message, and the return value is always going to be a single message. In fact, it's mandatory that it's a message, so we have this dummy message called empty, which is going to be just message empty with nothing inside it, because I have to put a message there. Yes?
Is there a particular reason why you have a separate argument for makedir args and listdir args while they're both defined to just be a single string?
This question, is there a reason why I have a separate message message type for each? That is not necessary. I did it on the assumption that maybe I want to add things to this in the future, and it would be really convenient to have them be separate types for that. Okay. Other questions? That's a good question. Yeah, and said, so there's two versions of this syntax. The version we're using for the assignment omits this required and optional keyword, which is simpler, and I should have updated this slide to reflect that. But I think we prefer the simpler one for the assignment. Okay. So then we have to implement this in a class. So the way this works, this is Python code. I hope we're not going to be too miffed by object-oriented Python code, because I know that's not actually a super common thing in prior classes. So here, I have some modules that are generated by tool that comes with library, that comes with gRPC. So gRPC generated these two libraries for me based on my IDL. And in one of them, I have a base class for the service that I want to implement. And in my base class, I define the method I want to override. And I take as arguments the request. This is the argument message. And I also get a context, which is something I can use to do special things with the RPC system. The example we see here is I want to tell the RPC system to return an error. And it has a special way of doing that. And I use the context object to access that. Context object also lets you access things like, if I want to know what the IP address of the client is, I can ask the context object for that information. Otherwise, I get my request object. It has, yes, I wasn't consistent. Okay. This should be .path because that's what I wrote on the prior slide. I can get the fields of the object, so that should be .path. So here I'm doing, this should be request.path because I have a path. So I should just get that field of an object, and that should also be path to be consistent. And I do what I wanted to do. So here I'm just calling the real makedir, and then I return an object, a message from that call in the normal case. So questions about this? I'm sorry for not really carefully proofreading this code after I changed it for using Python. Okay, so that's that. And here's our second method, and this should be, again, .path, because I'm being consistent. So here, I imported the message types we created. So these are the messages, message types, which I just imported from the generated code. So it generated a class for it, which also knows how to serialize and deserialize it. I get my request, I get the path from it, and I make a result object, and I append to the list inside it. And then I return that. And that directory list and directory entry class were all created because I defined them inside the IDL file, which I ran a tool, and it generated the Python code to implement them. Questions? Yeah. That's this IDEA file.
Oh.
So we have this. So the directory list and directory entry here, these were turned into Python classes. That works. Yes, and this directory is turned into a directory service, and so on, which is why how we have this base class. Yep. Apparently, I'm really consistent. That should be servicer. In the assignment, we supply you a working base code, so you don't have to worry about these details. Like the important thing, so we have this high level, so we have these generated classes, which have like accessors for all their fields and so on. Now that we've defined this directories impl class, so we have a class which has all the methods we want to be accessible remotely. So we have to somehow publish that on the network. And in gRPC, this is like very boilerplate code, but first we say, I want to create a server, and in fact, gRPC uses the thread pool pattern for implementing its servers. So here I'm saying, make a server with a thread pool that has three threads that run things in it, and those threads in the pool will run handling a call. And then we say, we call this method from the generated code to say, here's my object of methods, an instance of a class I created, add it to the server. Once we do that, then we say how we want to run the server and how we want it to be accessible. So in this case, I'm giving an IP address and port number. IP address is before the colon, port number is after, and then I just say to start it, and it runs in a separate thread. And the RPC library is handling all the work of calling these methods we defined before. So, questions? here. So this is the server side. So on the server side, we had this generated code which defined our types for our messages, so these container types with all the fields we could access, and we made a subclass of a base class that was generated for us and defined the methods that we said we would implement. And then we just provide it and say, run a server at this port. And now, when we make a client, we can use that. So for the client, I say, I want to connect to this port number. This should match the server. Match server. Probably didn't do that. So we just apply the same thing where the server is. And then we make a stub. So there's a stub class that's provided. We say, give me a stub for these methods with this destination. Here's where the server is. And then we call it just like call with the arguments. So we get our arguments. This should be a path again. I probably should just change the IDL, I guess. And then we make a call, just like a normal method call. And you saw that we could have an error. The error in Python turns into an exception. Okay, hopefully this is less noisy. Okay, so questions here? Yeah. So the question is, how would this look like I have more than two clients in a server? So this client program, I can run like 10 copies at once. And with that thread pool, the way I configured it here, up to 3 of them would get their calls run at the same time. The others would have to wait. Yeah?
Is there a way to run multiple servers, any of which can respond to a request from a client?
Is there a way to run multiple servers, any of which can respond to a request from a client? Not with gRPC. You're, as far as I know, your option is, well, I guess that's more complicated. So gRPC is implemented over HTTP, it turns out. So you could run something, there are tools for running an HTTP server which is backed by several other HTTP servers, so that would be the way you'd do it. There's not something built in. Okay. Other questions? And we could also call our method with and get a result. The result just gets returned as a return value, and it's a message, and we can, say, iterate through our return directory entries and print out all the file names we saw. And again, hopefully we'll remember to make things consistent between my slides. The same path. Questions on this? Yes, I will try to correct these slides to be more consistent about between all of them, but this is supposed to be basically a self-contained example. So you see we have this interface here that, you know, provides something kind of like a local procedure call. Like, ultimately, it ends up looking like that, but this isn't what the API would look like in Python. Like, we wouldn't have this object here. We would just pass the name. We wouldn't have this result type with a dot entries. We just probably return the value or something. We would probably have a better exception type than gRPC error. And also, we have the part we mentioned at the beginning wasn't like a local procedure call, which is that we need to say, where's the server? So RPC, you know, it's kind of transparent. It kind of looks like a local procedure call, but overall, you got these big problems. So the setup, like, that's not transparent. And we saw that the compromises we made for support being language neutral and so on were not transparent. So And we also have some more fundamental reasons why things might not be transparent. One of the big ones is errors happen. Now, we saw errors like I tried to make a directory and it failed. Well, that's pretty normal. That's not bizarre. But we have other errors which can happen. Because what if the network is down? That's a new type of error that was never possible on our local procedure call. What if the server seg faults while it's servicing our call? Well, that's not going to actually crash our program, but we need to somehow reflect that as an error back. So in gRPC, any RPC can return an error. And this is true in most RPC systems, that any RPC operation, it's always possible that it can return an error, even if there's nothing that the call does which can possibly fail. And so in the Python client, this throws an exception. But this exception could be, you know, either the case where the call explicitly said, this didn't work, I couldn't make the directory, or it could be a bunch of other things. So one example is the method wasn't implemented. That yes, you talked to an RPC server, but you talked to the wrong version. That method wasn't there. Sorry. Or we talked to the RPC server and we didn't get a response back, you know, after a minute. Is it, maybe it's working? Or there was some network problem. We're also going to talk a little later. There's some differences because versions are out of sync and the performance is very different. So there's another issue with failures, which happens because, well, what about resources on the server? So you might say, let's implement our normal file API. You know, this is what I'm doing here. I have a remote open, remote write, remote print, and remote close. So I'm doing open, print, close to a remote machine with RPC calls. And this is definitely an API I could implement. But there's a problem with failures. And a big part of this problem is, well, we have this file handle thing. What if the network breaks here? Will the file ever get closed? And the answer is probably not. The file stays open. The server is still running happily, it's just that the network between our client and the server broke. Or maybe the client shut down. And so we have this problem of leaking resources. So the server doing this. And this is something we have to worry about when we're writing an RPC server, is that we don't want our calls to look like this. Even though this is a great interface for doing things locally, we don't actually want to have a file handle we allocated on the server, because then we have to deal with all these questions about how do I get rid of them if the something goes wrong. But the server is still running. That's another way things aren't transparent. And another issue is versioning. That when we upgrade our RPC server, we can't do that in perfect sync with our clients. With a library, you just say, well, don't recompile your application until you've fixed it to work with the new version of the library. That's not really an option for our RPC server, where we have to change it at some point and people are using it remotely. So gRPC's solution to this is that they have field numbers. So their idea is if you add arguments to a method, instead you just take the message that it's its argument and add new fields to it. Because they have numbers, if a client's talking to an old server, it's going to ignore those extra fields. If a client gets a response from a newer server with extra fields in it, it's going to ignore them. And you can just design around this to make sure it works as you upgrade either the client or server. Not quite in sync. Now, if you aren't doing that, the gRPC solution is, well, add a new method. Just make a new method name each time. And it turns out that gRPC sends the method name over the network. You might complain about that, but that's the choice they've made. So you can just make a new name, and that's how you make it so you can have two incompatible versions. And the idea is you keep the old name around until you decided not to support it anymore. Another approach that some RPC systems that aren't gRPC use is they just put a version number in the protocol. So like the IDL will have service directories, and will have a version equals 1, and when you change it, you upgrade it to 2, you set that to 2, and you can have a server which has a version 1 and a version 2 implementation. And that's a way of handling upgrading without creating problems. Okay, so questions about versioning? Okay. So another thing about RPC is performance. And this is a reason where we get disappointed about, you know, sort of our remote file handle. That when we're acting locally, we call print a lot of times. And that's fine. If we're doing that remotely, well, you know, our normal calls to print were microseconds. Our remote procedure calls, are gonna be sort of, in our best case, are going to be a lot slower. A lot, lot slower. Even if we have a super fast network, and when I say super fast network, that is way, way faster than talking to two machines on typical Wi-Fi that are next to each other. But if I have a super fast network, even then, it's a lot slower than a local call would be. And this is going to affect the design of a good RPC server. You're not going to provide the same sort of functions you might provide. You're going to want to make sure you do enough work to make this minimum amount of time you have to wait for things to go over the network to be worthwhile. Okay. Also, speaking of doing things locally, I mentioned when we talked about sockets that we had these Unix domain sockets, which were the socket API, but on the same machine. It's also common to, in the same kind of philosophy, to use remote procedure calls locally. So remember I showed you, some local services which were running for windowing and so on. Some of those might use the RPC server design locally, just to communicate between processes, because it's still a nice abstraction. And if you're implementing it locally, well, you could maybe make it use shared memory or something, and make it be really almost as fast as a local procedure call. Okay. So questions about RPC? Okay. So when I talked about RPC, I mentioned this issue of errors, that things could fail. And that's something we need to be concerned with. And here, we've only just been concerned with, if they fail, we want to know about it. Well, we're going to think more about failure. And failure is really what the next assignment is about. So to think about this, we need to know, how do things fail? So how do networks fail? And we're going to have this very high-level model of how a network works. We're going to deal with two kinds of failure. That we send messages. Remember this mailbox model. So we send messages over our network, and the messages could be lost, or they could be delayed or reordered. Now, when a message is lost, how does that look? So a message being lost, and a key problem with dealing with network failures is that when a message is lost, it looks the same as the machine failing. Right? It's basically the same thing. You can't reliably distinguish between the two. Now, you can try to tell if a message is lost with acknowledgments, and we'll show what that is. And we can recover by retrying to send the message, because hopefully if a message is lost, it's not the case that every single message is going to be lost. So, for example, let's say we make an RPC call to append to a file. Well, if I don't get any response to that call, I don't know whether it worked or not. I can't tell, did machine B get that and it just failed? Or did machine B not get it and that's why it failed? So I can't tell the difference between these scenarios if I'm machine A. All I know is I sent something to machine B, I don't know what happened to it. So what we want to do to be able to deal with this is have machine B say, yes, I did it. But that's great. But the problem is that not getting a response doesn't actually tell us it didn't do it. Maybe it did it, and then the response got lost. So what's our solution to this? Well, in this case, we don't want to just say append to file A again, because if we do that, now file A contains two copies of what we appended. We want to somehow say append, but only if you already have it. So our key idea is we're going to retry, but we're going to retry in a way which is idempotent. So remember when we had redo logs, we talked about we want to write like the value is now 4, not increment the value, because we knew we were going to redo it on failure. Same principle is going to apply for the messages we're going to tell machine B to do. So that when we retry, we want to retry in a way where we know that if we missed this acknowledgement, we're still safe. So this is the best we can do, basically, because messages can be lost. And there's an unanswered question here without a good answer. Eventually, we should give up. If we keep sending this over and we never get that yup done back, eventually we want to say, well, probably machine B was unplugged or something. But when do we do that? There's not a good answer, right? We're going to have to make some assumptions. And in the case where machine B never gives a response back to us, well, we're never going to learn whether or not the file was modified. Too bad. Okay. So questions about acknowledgement strategy? Yeah.
Is there a time wait for machine A to send the message again?
So the question is there a time I wait for time machine B waits or
no, like machine A sends it, doesn't get anything.
Yeah, so the question your question is what is this amount of time? And that is another, you know, that is another sort of choice you have to make. Until you get the response, you obviously have to assume it may or may not be done. But yeah, the choice of how long do I wait to retry, that's a tricky one. And if you take networking, they might talk about the considerations involved in that. So our other type of failure is what if messages are reordered? And just like we can't really distinguish between the network is losing messages and the machine is down, we can't distinguish between the message got delayed and the message got lost. Because, well, if we haven't got the message yet, maybe it's just delayed more. You know, we waited an hour, maybe it got delayed an hour. So in general, you can't tell. And so we have this acknowledgement scheme. So this is something that connections generally try to do. But in the case where they actually give up, they're going to fail. So a connection protocol is going to do these acknowledgements, but if it has to give up, it's going to fail, and we don't know whether or not the message got there. In the case of reordering, this is something that message protocols will try to handle with sequence numbers. They'll just number every message so they can put them back in order. RPC abstraction, notably, doesn't really do this. Each RPC call could be reordered, and they're not going to stop it, because there's not an inherent ordering if they come from different clients or something, or even from one client, if there could be separate connections. But the basic idea, you have these sequence numbers, you add them to each of your messages, so then when machine B gets it, it can acknowledge them and tell you which one it's acknowledging, and can also put them back together in the correct order even though it might not receive them in the correct order. Questions? Yes. Okay. So that's about how networks fail. So now we're going to talk about how machines fail. And there are two models for machine failure I'm going to talk about, and only one we're actually going to deal with. So the two models are fail-stop and Byzantine failures. So fail-stop means that my model is when machine fails, it just stops responding like it lost power. So it stops responding, or it doesn't get messages, or you detect it's broken and you know you can ignore it. Like it fails in an obvious way and just doesn't work, or you ignore it. That's fail-stop. And that's how we'd like failures to work. Because we can make that happen well. And we're going to talk about how to deal with fail-stop failures. But you might recognize, you know, sometimes when my laptop fails, the screen has all sorts of crazy stuff on it, and other weird things happen. So we have there's an alternate failure model of Byzantine failures. So in this model, we assume the failing machine looks at all the possible things it could do and chooses whichever is most inconvenient for us. Now, you might say, that's not realistic, and indeed, it's not. It's not going to choose the most inconvenient thing or do any possible thing. But the idea is that if we build things that work with Byzantine failures, a certain number of them, then we can handle any scenario. And defining precisely what are realistic failures, since we know more than a fail stop is possible, we can get corrupted messages and so on. Defining what realistic failures are is really hard. So people try to figure out, how can I just handle all failures with the Byzantine failures? So we're going to mostly talk about this fail-stop model, but I want you to be aware that, well, of course, machines fail in other ways. It's just a lot more complicated to figure out how to deal with that. So our solution for dealing with failures, the primary one we're going to deal with, and the one that comes up in assignment, is we're going to recover when the machine comes back up. So the machine fails, it loses power, and we want to deal with that scenario, and when the machine's available again, we want everything to go perfectly well after that. So this is going to be analogous to how we wanted file systems to recover with redo logging. But we're going to do this across multiple machines. Another solution, which we're going to mention briefly, is that you could rely on a quorum of machines working. You could say, I have three machines. If any two of them are working, I should still have my system working. And that's a more complicated, but obviously it means that you stay working. So that's the other sort of model. And this is how you can deal with Byzantine failures. So with Byzantine failures, you say, I want to deal with this with any one of my machines failing in the worst possible way, like all sorts of corrupt data going out. I want to handle that, but I have five machines, and I only care if one of them fails. And that's sort of why you can deal with that horrible, worst possible thing happens when it fails, because we're going to limit how many things fail. Okay, so questions on our failure models? Okay, so we're going to look at covering, and we're going to solve a particular problem dealing with these failures, and that's distributed transactions. So we talked about transactions in our local file systems where we do something all at once. So with the distributed transaction, we're going to have multiple machines agree to do something all at once, or if they don't succeed in doing that, nothing's going to happen. Just like with our file system, we're going to have a bunch of updates, and unless we agree to commit the transaction, everyone does that, nothing's going to change. So we want to do this across multiple machines. And our primary goal is going to be that even when things fail, we have a consistent state. That we never end up with a case where we have something analogous to we created a file, but we didn't create its directory entry. We want to have that sort of consistency. Our secondary goal is that if nothing breaks, we want to actually do the operation. And the reason I have that secondary goal is I have an easy solution to this distributed transaction problem without that secondary goal, which is never do it. Just never do anything. Just give up right away. But we don't want to do that. We want to usually do it, but when things fail, we want to have safe results. And to give an example of a motivation for this, let's say I have a database for SIS, and it's distributed across several machines. I have two machines which have student records, and I have another machine which has all the course records. And I want to have a student added to a course, and that's going to involve updating a student record and a course record. And I want to make sure that there's no confusion at any point about whether a student is in a course. That if I ask machine A, what courses is the student in, and I ask machine C, who's in this course, the answers don't look contradictory. And I want this to happen even if, like, machine A gets unplugged in the middle of an update and then gets plugged back in. And the way we're going to handle this is that we're going to say, well, you can't do the update, things are broken right now, try it later. We can't add you to the course, try again later, or maybe the web client will automatically try again, or something like that. So let's first talk about why do we need to do something special here. So here's my proposed procedure for adding a student to a course. I'm going to choose the machine where the student record is. Let's say it's A. So let's say the student's on A. So on A, I send a message to C saying, add the student to the course. I wait for C to respond and say, yep, I did that. And then I add the student to the course. So where can I have inconsistencies if I do this? What things could be inconsistent? So your question is, what if A fails, then when A comes back up, the student is in the course on A, but it's in the course on C. So there's even something which can go wrong if I don't have failures. Yeah. Yeah, so what could happen is I could right here, let's say I'm my faculty, I'm looking at the student list, I say, who's in my course? Who is in my course? I say, student in course, but course on course list, but not on the advisor view. So the advising view will pick up the student record. It's going to show me, oh, my advisee is not in my course. I look at my course list, my advisee is in my course. And depending on how long this process takes, that could last, who knows how long. And, it could last a few milliseconds, or that could be true for minutes if something gets slow. And we want to prevent that. In addition to making it so when things fail that we have consistent results. So I have a simple centralized solution. We're going to choose and make a new machine D, and D is going to decide what happens. And D is going to do all the changes, and it's going to maintain a redo log. And that's how it's going to ensure consistency on crashes. We're going to have to do a little extra work to make sure we see consistent results, but as things are happening, we'll have to deal with that later. But this at least seems to solve the failure problem. But you probably don't like the solution. So what don't you like about this for solving failures? This works for dealing with failures. This will deal with any machine failing, including D. When it comes back up, when D comes back up, it redoes the operations. If machine A or B or C fails, D is responsible for, retry. If A, B, C fail, can retry that. So what's the annoyance? Yeah.
What do you do if D fails?
So if D fails, when it comes back up, it reads its log and redoes everything. But we do have this issue that if D fails, now everything doesn't work. Now, this might not be such a big issue with this system where all our course records are in one machine, but if we split up the course records across multiple machines, then we'd expect if only one machine goes down that the whole system doesn't go down. But this is going to make it so, you know, D goes down, everything goes down. We also have the issue that now if D, you know, gets overloaded, too bad. You can't do anything on sys anymore. You know, and we don't want that. Part of the reason we might have had multiple machines is because we assumed it was too much work for one. And now we're making it work for all one machine again. And another reason we might not like this is because we kind of combine responsibility. Like, why did we separate the student and course records? If it was just for, like, convenience, this is not a big deal. But if it's because a different part of the university manages the student records and manages the course records, and they want to have control over them, then this might not be acceptable. Because now D is like has to be owned by both of them, because it contains the latest version in some cases. So we're going to talk about a decentralized solution where each machine only handles its own data. We're not going to have like a central redo log. There's no central place for things. And a machine is only involved in a transaction if it needs to be. We're not going to have extra machines involved just to coordinate. That, for example, if I'm changing only student information, I'm not going to need to have it stored centrally. I just tell the student machine. If I'm changing, you know, not changing students on machine B, machine B is never involved. Just never touches it. And this means that hopefully we'll have good performance even if we have, you know, tens of thousands of machines, because each of our transactions is probably like 1 to 3. And we also want to make progress as long as none of the machines involved in the transaction fail. So we want to have this property that if there's something, some machine that fails that isn't where my data is, things should still work. And we're going to try to do that. So the solution we're going to look at that satisfies these properties is known as two-phase commit. It's two-phase because we have two steps. Our first step is figure out what to do. Our second step is actually do it. And when we figure out what to do, we're going to have to agree on what happens. Now, I want to deal with failures, and I'm going to use the technique we've used to deal with what if the machine like loses power and fails, and that we're going to have a persistent log on each machine. So if a machine fails and stops, when it comes back up, it's going to remember the last thing it put in its log. That doesn't mean it remembers everything which happened, because maybe it received a message and then lost power before it could write something down in its log. But it's going to remember the last thing it finished writing to its log. And that's how it's going to remember what was supposed to be happening when it was failing. So when it comes back up, it's going to need to figure out what was actually happening with all the other machines and make sure a consistent result happens. So all the machines are going to have to agree on the result, and most of our work is going to be about making sure that gets communicated consistently. So to do this, we're going to divide our machines up into two roles. We're going to choose one machine to be a coordinator for each transaction. This could be on the same physical machine as one of the machines with the data or not. And we're going to have the other machines we're going to call workers. So everyone is going to decide what they want to do for the transaction. So one option is that we can abort. If anyone decides to abort, so everyone decides, so workers decide versus abort or commit. Or try to commit. So if anyone decides to abort, we're going to give up. So why might they decide to abort? Well, maybe if something failed, we'll give up. Or maybe, like, I'm trying to add the student to the course, and the course might be full. We'll give up. And the coordinator is going to collect all the workers' votes on what do they want to do. And based on that, it's going to make the final decision and communicate that to the workers. Now, a key reason that this is going to be provide consistency is that we're going to make sure that when we make a decision, we don't take it back. The coordinator makes a decision, and it's going to write it down in this log, and that decision is never, ever going to change. And this is how we make sure we either do the operation or we don't. So once a worker agrees to abort, it's not going to change his mind. That's another thing we're going to do. So a worker agrees to abort, doesn't change his mind. When a coordinator makes a decision, that doesn't change. Remember it in a log. So, yes.
Does that mean that if a worker decides to abort, can they choose not to abort? Or is it locked in for either case?
So if the worker decides to abort, it must never tell, after it decides to abort, it can never tell the coordinator it didn't decide to abort. It has to not take that decision back. And our coordinator is going to make a decision about what happens for the entire transaction. So if everyone says commit, we're going to choose to commit, and everyone's going to actually do the transaction. Otherwise, we're going to choose to abort. Now, there's going to be some cases when the coordinator doesn't know. In that case, the coordinator has two options. One option is it can say, I give up, we are aborting. The other option is it can say, I'm going to wait. And both are fine. So, so that's our model. So we're going to have our two phases. So in our preparing phase, the coordinator is going to ask the workers for their votes. And the workers are going to say, I agree to commit, in which case they're going to say, I'm definitely going to accept and do this transaction eventually, if you want to. Or they're going to agree to abort. In that case, they're going to say, I'm never going to do this transaction. You know, I'm just not going to do it. And they never take this back. Once they agree to commit or agree to abort, they can't take that back because otherwise the coordinator could come to inconsistent decisions. So in order to not take this back, before they send their vote, they're going to have to log it locally. Now, this means that they can't allow interfering operations. So for example, if I agree to add a student to a class, I need to reserve a seat in that class, even though it might not be used. Also, if I agree to add a student to the class, I can't definitely tell you while that's happening, is the student going to be in the class? Now, the coordinator makes a global decision. It records it in persistent log so it's not forgotten. And if the coordinator fails without a decision in its log, it just asks for the votes again. And that's safe because we know the workers never change their votes. And we have the finishing phase. So in the finishing phase, the coordinator tells each of the workers what happened. Tells commit. If so, they actually apply the transaction. If they say abort, they abort the transaction. And if you're unsure which to do, you ask the coordinator. Or, alternately, the coordinator could try to make sure it resends the outcome if you don't get it. So this is the option we're actually going to use in the assignment, is that we're going to say, you know, the coordinator is responsible for resending if a worker doesn't acknowledge, yes, I got your commit, or yes, I got your report. Now, to make this work, the two-phase commit is going to provide consistency, but it's going to provide consistency at a cost. And that big cost is that when we agree to commit something, we have to make sure we don't take contradictory actions. So one example is if I agree to add a student to the class, I can't add a student to another class, conflicting class. I can't remove the student from the class. I can't, you know, I have to leave a seat open in the class just in case until we know the actual outcome, because we don't know whether or not it's going to happen, but we've agreed that we're definitely going to let it happen if the coordinator says commit. So in our assignment, the way this manifests is the option is agree to commit write value X. That means you can't allow reads while this is happening, while pending. So in the assignment, we have you store a single value. While it's being written, you don't know whether it's the old or new version. You can't allow reads. You just have to say, no, I don't know. And that's our version of this for the assignment. But in a database, it would be like, I have to keep the seat open in the class because the student might be using it, even though I don't know whether or not this will actually work. And because we have to not allow conflicting actions, and because we have failures, one concern you might have is, well, how long could we wait? How long do I have to keep that seat open in the class? And, well, if the machine just goes away, one of the machines in the transaction goes away during the transaction and doesn't come back, well, potentially forever. And in practice, when this happens, well, you have to intervene manually. So, like, let's say one of the machines holding the records, like, just fails completely and even its log isn't recoverable. In that case, well, all the other machines have these pending transactions that they're, like, reserving space for, and we'll need some manual intervention to fix it. And there's some things we can do to hopefully prevent this from happening as often, but it won't always work. So one thing we can do is we can say, well, if the coordinator hasn't made its final decision yet, we should abort in this case. But that's not always possible, because we have to do that before the decision is made. Remember, we can't take back a commit decision. So we can only do that if we haven't decided to commit yet. But if we haven't decided to commit, we can just say, well, one of the workers went away during the transaction. That's fine. Another way we can mitigate this is, let's say the coordinator failed, but the coordinator made its decision. If any worker knows about the decision, they can tell the other workers, potentially. So that would solve it. So if a coordinator told one worker commit, but the other messages were lost, and then the coordinator was, like, shut down, well, we can learn that it was committed, and that's fine enough. Or if we learn that any worker voted to abort the transaction, we know it's going to abort, so we don't need the coordinator's decision. But these mitigations don't handle all the cases. That's why I said mitigations, because you can still have, like, the coordinator fail after it's collected the votes, and a worker fails, so you can't tell whether that worker got the commit outcome or not. In that case, you can't recover from this without making a manual decision. So, questions on that idea? Yeah?
How does the coordinator keep track of how many workers it actually has?
The question is, how does the coordinator know how many workers it has? So, in our assignment, we just give you a list. So in a typical real system, it's going to depend on the operation. Like, if we're adding a student to the class, well, we know it's whatever machine's responsible for the student in the class. And we're thinking about a database. Typically, it's based on, well, where is this data stored? That would be a common way.
So then how do you know if it failed or it just left?
How do I know if the coordinator failed?
No, if one of the workers, like, just doesn't respond in time versus it.
So the question is, how do I distinguish if a worker doesn't respond in time versus it's down? I can't. So if a worker doesn't respond in time, I need to assume it's probably, I need to assume the worst, which is probably that it got my message and then failed, you know, or didn't get my message. Either way, I need to do something that's safe in both cases. And because we can't distinguish the two, like, this is why since we can't know the machine is definitely down, this is why we have to just wait, right? Because, like, you might say as a human, the machine's been down for 5 days, it's not coming back up, but we can't say that because of our strict definitions of consistency, that's gonna definitely true. Okay, questions? So let's look at sort of this a little more concretely. So we're going to have, basically, here we have different messages we need to send. So we're going to have our coordinator is going to start off a transaction with a prepare message, where it's going to say, here's what I want you to do. Will you do it? The workers are going to respond by saying either yes, I will, or no, I won't. The coordinator collects those responses from the workers and either tells it, okay, everyone, we're committing or we're aborting. And that's the global decision that everyone does. And I'm going to represent this as a state machine because this is typically how we reason about protocols like this. So in our state machine, we're going to say that our coordinator starts in this initializing state. Then it sends a prepare message to all. And when it does that, it goes to this waiting state. And it stays in this waiting state until it either receives agree to commit from everyone or receives agree to abort from anyone. And when it receives agree to abort from anyone, it tells everyone abort. Otherwise, it tells everyone commit. And if it receives agree to commit from everyone. And we have a detail that's not shown on this picture, which is that in addition to accumulating votes, we need to handle what if the worker didn't get our prepare. So after some time, we're going to resend that prepare message. Or after we notice like the network is down, we're going to resend the prepare message. And in either of these cases, we might need to resend the abort or commit message if it doesn't get sent. And that's why I have these states. So if I'm in the aborted state, I know, well, if a worker contacts me, I'm going to tell it we're aborted. If I'm in the commit state, if a worker contacts me, I'm going to tell it again, we're committed. I guess you just didn't get the message. Or otherwise agree to resend. Yeah?
If the coordinator gets just one agree to abort, does it abort immediately or does it wait for all the work?
The question is, if the coordinator gets one to agree to abort, does it abort immediately? It is allowed to abort immediately. It doesn't have to, but it is allowed to abort immediately because it knows that's the only possible outcome. Okay, other questions? So we have our coordinator. And another reason to have these states is that we can think of the state as being what we put in our log. That if we log that we're in the waiting state, we know, well, if I failed and come back up, I'm waiting for votes. Let's try to ask for the votes again. If I log I'm in the aborted state, I know, well, I failed after I aborted the transaction. Let's just make sure everyone got the message, and so on. So that's what we're going to keep down. And this tells us what to do on crashes. So I have one possible option here. So if we're in the init state, we send the prepare again. We assume it didn't get sent. If we're in the wait or aborted state, we can send abort. And you might say, wait, if we're in the wait state, shouldn't we just resend prepare? That's another valid option. We could also send resend prepare, but the simplest thing to do is just say, well, I give up. I know I didn't commit the transaction, so it's safe to abort it. So I'm just going to do that. That's the simple solution. And if it's commit, we just resend commit. And then we have, what if we don't get votes? So I didn't show you that. If we don't get votes, we either resend the prepare to try to get the votes and wait, or we abort. And if the commit or abort doesn't make it to the worker, the worker can ask later. Worker can ask later because maybe it has a timeout saying, if I don't get a response, I just send my vote again and say, hey, coordinator, what's happening? Or the coordinator can ask for an acknowledgement. And if it doesn't get one, it can resend after some amount of time. So you may have noticed from this description here that there's a bunch of things I omitted from this diagram here. So here's a like more complete version. Like we have these sort of what if something fails? What do we do if we get a vote? That isn't one of the things that makes us go to another state. You know, we have some options here, and I mentioned resend prepare or abort here. But we have these other cases that I was missing. And the advantage of this state machine representation is that it's relatively easy to look at each state and saying, what do I do for each case and see if I'm missing something. And so I did that analysis, and this is my more complete version of the state machine. You notice I'm still missing a few things like init and so on. I'm not going to bother drawing the fully complete state machine here. So on the worker side, we also have a similar state machine where the worker starts in this waiting state, initialization state. It gets a prepare message, and it either agrees to commit or agrees to abort. If it agrees to abort, it can just abort right away because it knows that that's going to be the outcome. It doesn't need to track any extra state. If it agrees to commit, it remembers it's in the agreed to commit state, so it doesn't take back that vote and waits till it receives a commit or receives an abort to decide what to do. And again, we have some failure cases to handle. So one example is if we get another prepare, we resend our vote. And there's a few other failure cases I didn't show. So as I mentioned, the advantage of the state machine model for drawing these things is that when we're looking at doing this more formally, this is a way we can make sure we've dealt with every case. We can look at, in this state, what happens for each message, and I have a list of, there's only 5 possible messages I can possibly receive, plus failures and plus a local failure or a timeout. So I can just enumerate all the cases. You know, I can say, oh, what if I get an abort while I'm aborted? Oh, don't do anything. Okay, that's easy. What if I get abort and init? Oh, I probably should just abort. Go to aborted, that makes sense. What if I get prepare and committed? Should think about that. Probably ignore it, but something might be wrong. And there's another missing detail, which is we want to eventually discard transactions. So eventually we want to forget about a transaction and not get confused by delayed messages. So a way we'll do this commonly is we'll have like a sequence number for each transaction. So if we get a message from a transaction we know is all done, we'll just ignore it. Like this prepare and committed, maybe that prepare was just a delayed message, in which case we should ignore it because we already responded. Okay. So that gives, so to illustrate this like more concretely, so here's our normal operation. That coordinator tells everyone to prepare, everything's fine, everyone agrees to commit, coordinator actually commits. And remember that the coordinator logs when it goes to a different state, so if it crashes at any point, it knows what's happening. And the worker logs when it goes to a different state, so there's a missing case here where it logs log state equals committed. But notably, it logs its vote, so it knows not to take it back. And we have our case, let's say the class is full, we just say, I can't do that right now. And the coordinator tells everyone to abort. Okay, and I'll finish up with a failure, with a simple failure example, and we'll do some more failure examples next time. So one failure example is, let's say the worker tries to prepare. We do a prepare and the worker fails. So one possibility is the worker comes back up and it doesn't record anything, doesn't know anything. But one possibility is the coordinator just says, okay, I didn't get a response from you in a while, let me try again. And that just fixes it. So another possibility is maybe we're lazy and the coordinator doesn't want to try resending, and we just say, oh, didn't get a response, I give up. And that's what, this is the simplest thing to implement, right? We just say, that it doesn't even matter if we agreed to commit because, well, you know, the coordinator gives up. We don't care what worker 2's vote is. We're just aborting. We just decided that. Okay, and that's where we're going to leave off today because I'm already over time. I'm sorry about that.